Get ready for a journey into the heart of Bridgeport politics with In Absentia, a new podcast from Connecticut Public's investigative team, The Accountability Project. Learn about the city's past and present political dysfunction and the systems that enable it. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts.
Funding provided by Gregory Melville and Susan Fox and Kathleen Bromage.
Man, I've got certain information, all right? Certain things have come to light, and, you know, has it ever occurred to you that instead of, running around blaming me, you know, given the nature of all this new shit, you know, this could be a lot more complex. I mean, it's not just, it might not be just such a simple, you know?
What in God's holy name are you blathering about?
I'll tell you what we're blathering about. We're blathering about cult movies today. Cult classics, cult movies, it's all a very complicated thing. And we usually open our show with music, but I thought, why not open with the clips from the movies that are the thing that we'll be talking about? So that's what we're doing today. With us, first of all, in studio with me, and I think we just determined that they might have been on during the first week of the existence of this show, 15 mm-hmm. years ago. Mm-hmm. Sam Hatch and Kevin O'Toole, they are the co-host of the Culture Dogs, Sunday nights on WWUH. Don't miss them. You'll also hear a little drop-ins from a visit I had with my friend David Edelstein. Like, well, all we ever do is talk about movies. Anyway, America's greatest living film critic. And then we're very excited to have with us Millie DeShirico, who's the author of TCM Underground, 50 Must-See Films from the World of Classic Cult and Late Night Cinema, and co-host of the I Saw What You Did film podcast. We're going to play a little clip now. One of the producers of this episode, the primary producer of this episode, our intern, Sajina Shrestha, went out into the world, into the teeming masses, and asked them about cult movies. Maestro, A1.
When I say cult classic, what movies come to mind?
Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Joel Schumacher's Batman and Robin. Little Nicky with Adam Sandler.
The Big Lebowski.
Pulp Fiction.
I think the movie The Room.
What makes a cult classic is something that doesn't do well when it comes out and is just like banned by critics, and then over time develops a following of its own where people recognize something valuable in it.
Something that was also maybe kind of frowned upon in a way or made fun of, but was undeniably cool and different. It's a movie that you can't compare to really any other movie, and I think that's why it's a cult classic.
There used to be like really few movies that would gain that description, and now it's like anything that was not recognized during its time, and then suddenly there's a kind of revision, like, I don't know, Heaven's Gate or After Hours, the Scorsese. It's like, those are not cult classics. Those are just movies that are being recognized in time, but it's not the same as having fandom, like a lot of people really loving that movie.
All right, that was a great montage. There was one voice in that montage, though, which I feel like somebody said to AI, do the voice of a cult movie nerd for us. I'm sorry, I don't mean to in any way cast asparagus on whoever that was who was talking.
Cast asparagus on them, Colin.
Yeah, and
go for it.
The other thing I would say is no one has ever rehabilitated Heaven's Gate. No one, anywhere.
Yeah.
That is a movie that cannot be rehabilitated. And I know because I tried one time. That's a failed premise. But first of all, those are some pretty interesting descriptions. And Millie, we should start with you. Did they nail it? Are some things that they... This is a very difficult term to define. And it maybe even describes two or three different types of movies. But how are we doing so far, Millie?
I'd say pretty good. I definitely think it's kind of a combo platter of a lot of those things that were said. I like the idea of something being reinterpreted or rediscovered, but also the fandom component, I think, is a big part of it too. So, yeah.
I mean, your book is interesting too, because I see a lot of movies, and we talk about movies a lot on this show. There's a long list of movies that I'm going to have to see now. I mean, it's unusual to have that many movies in a book that I haven't seen. But I guess that's kind of priced into the topic, Millie, that cult movies are, by definition, probably movies that 90 to 95% of people have not seen.
Right. And as time has moved forward, the people have seen more and more things. So that list becomes a lot different than it was, say, when I was growing up and, you know, knowing that I had to hit certain, you know, cult canon like Eraserhead and Pink Flamingos and that kind of stuff. So, yeah, I think now as access to films has gotten better and better since the internet, you know, getting stumped, getting truly stumped is getting harder. So,
well, I think there's another part of this, too, which is that movies these days like this can get fan bases. I mean, it used to be all entirely word of mouth for a cult classic, a cult movie. It was pretty much spread that way. These days, you know, I don't know. I mean, a lot of these movies have, there's a River's Edge movie fan page on Facebook. It has like 156 people on it. But, you know, if you want to find all the other people who like a movie, quite frequently they've already done it for you. They've gotten together somewhere on social media and you're welcome to join.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, also the idea that films are sort of missing is changed a lot, too. So there's just more access to things. You know, there was a lot of films when I was growing up that I just thought I'd never see that are now in like a 4K Blu-ray restoration. So, you know, I think it encourages people to see more things and to congregate in their little weird Facebook groups. So
let me go over to the Culture Dogs now. Kevin, how are we doing so far? Are we leaving out some aspect of this phenomenon?
No, I like the orbit of where the definition is heading there. Although, again, as you know, what Millie was calling the fandom component, I think that really defines it. It's like you're going to have to define it by the group you hang out with, too. It's like, you know, for instance, like Hallmark movies can be a cult film audience there, certainly to me, because I don't watch them really. But I know people who are quite big fans of them. A number of people worked on them too, for that matter. It's like, you know, it's the thing. It's among the little bits of fandom, pockets of fandom you find out there.
Especially Hallmark movies like The Attractive New York Couple with the Sink That Regurgitated Blood. That one in particular, I think, you know, which is a little different from most of what they
Wasn't that Paul Warrenoff's or Mary Warrenoff's last Hallmark movie?
So Sam, how about, are we leaving anything out so far?
I'd like the concept of the film versus the fandom and how that interacts as well, too, because there's certain films nowadays that are considered mainstream, especially among cult film aficionados, because the audience has possibly grown too large over the years. So something like Evil Dead, you know, from the early 80s by Sam Raimi, is now so popular amongst, you know, horror film fans and cult film fans that it's essentially a Citizen Kane of that whole kind of genre. So now there's other films that are possibly so cult that there are like two people that like them, like myself. Solar Crisis 2050 by Richard Serafian. I don't know anybody who actually likes that film.
I've been meaning to see it.
Yeah, Charlton Heston is in it, and Peter Boyle, so you're going to love it. So there's that sliding dynamic of how popular can it become before it stops being cult, and then what is too cult? Yeah.
You know, I mean, Millie, in a way, one of the things we're describing is kind of the so-called long tail, that you can have a movie that 7 million people went to see, or you can have a movie that 70,000 people are willing to see 10 times, and you'll still be a little bit behind the first movie, but it's that idea of the smaller audience that cares so passionately that they know a lot of the dialogue, right?
Yeah, I mean, kind of an interesting example of what you're talking about, and at least the first part of that, is a movie like Practical Magic, let's just say, with
my wife's favorite.
Sandra Bullock.
I have a poster in my house.
That's Sam Hatch's wife. Yes.
Multiple copies on Laserdisc and DVD.
Well, and it's so interesting because that movie was, you know, for the most part, a mainstream film when it came out, and, you know, a family film at that, and now it's gotten this kind of weird cult following with a you know, kids of a certain age, I think, were kind of nostalgic for that film, but then you know, creating a fandom around it where they have, you know, conventions and there's definitely, you know, Facebook groups and sort of other places on the internet where people are congregating, and I'm like, huh, this is really interesting, because it was a popular movie when it came out, then it kind of went away, and then now it's kind of being rediscovered by this smaller cult audience.
Right. So we should also check in absentia with David Edelstein. Let's play A2 Maestro.
Cult classic Once Upon a Time started very, very small. They were films that had virtually no audience. The people who saw them dismissed them. And slowly over time, they amassed a following that really transcended the work itself. There was a kind of built-in irony. It was a wonderfully inclusive thing to be part of a cult, to be in the cult that loved Night of the Living Dead or some very, very disreputable film that was generally dismissed by all the highbrows, or even the Rocky Horror Picture Show, which represented a kind of pansexuality, gayness and camp and pansexuality that had never been seen before in the mainstream, to the point where midnight rituals were built around it, call and responses. I mean, it was a religion.
While he was talking, I was also looking at Practical Magic because I didn't know what it was. It has Sandra Bullock and Nicole Kidman in it.
Indeed.
Yeah. So, you know, he mentions Rocky Horror Picture Show. And we should talk a little bit about, I think, another aspect of this, and it's not true for all cult movies, but having a level of almost embeddedness in the movie, which, of course, is what Rocky Horror Picture Show ultimately offers you, is a chance to kind of be in the movie. Mm. But it's also knowing the lines. This is not true for all movies. But, for example, we played Big Lebowski at the top. I would say Napoleon Dynamite is another cult movie where you know, if somebody says to you, well, do the chickens have talons? You know that they know this movie.
Immediately know.
Yeah. And so, you know, I'd love to hear from all of you about this. But, Millie, this can be almost like a liturgy, right? I mean, the Rocky Horror Picture stuff is like they're in church and they're just, you know, it's call and response.
Yeah, agreed. And I think that there's a movie called The Room. I think somebody mentioned it in the interview section where it's the same thing. I mean, people are throwing things at the screen and saying lines together. And, you know, so it kind of carries on that tradition of that kind of group participation. But also, like, you know, that could be a really fun way to experience a movie, considering now we're so kind of insular and in the house all the time. To be in that environment feels very culty to me still.
You know, I feel like I might not have mentioned the title of your book when I introduced you. I should say TCM Underground, 50 Must-See Films for the World of Classic Cult and Late Night Cinema. She's also co-host of the I Saw What You Did film podcast. So yeah, I mean, there's that pleasure too, right, Sam? When you know the lines, somebody else knows the lines.
I'm certainly flashing back to seeing Donnie Darko, a film by Richard Kelly, which is one of the, it's modern, but it's not modern. That's what, 20 years ago now. Yeah. But it's a modern-ish cult film that it had a natural growth of its fan base. And so I saw it, I think it played Cine Studio here locally. It was a very kind of quiet launch. It hit DVD, and then more and more people got involved with it. And then a few years later, they relaunched it in cinemas with a director's cut. And I drove up to Boston to see it. And wow, yeah. I mean, talk about a Rocky Horror-esque scenario where everybody knew that the kind of weird jokes and weird little intricacies that were coming and were just exploding when they happened. Yeah, so there's that real cathartic excitement of being in a room with a bunch of other like-minded freaks that all have been drawn to this one particular entity.
You know, Kevin, I think there's that sense, Sam has just beautifully described, of just sort of being one with one another.
One of us.
Very nice callback. Very nice callback. But in this kind of a sense of communion with both the other fans in the movie. But there's also the part where you, I know you have a good story to tell this, but I'll warm up the crowd. Not too long ago, I semi-insisted that my partner watch Napoleon Dynamite with me. And you know, there's that moment where the other person says, and you like this, why?
My wife also not a fan.
And Kevin, I think you've had that maybe with the movie Liquid Sky.
Oh, yes. Liquid Sky was I don't have my notes in front of me. I'm going to say 1982 feature.
Early 80s, yeah.
Was it in Carlisle? Anyways.
Indeed, yes.
This woman who played two parts, one a man, one a woman, but it was set mostly on the like New York art scene of the early 1980s. And the basic premise is that these aliens come down and land on top of her apartment, but they need fuel for their craft to get back to their home planet. And to do that, this fuel is apparently derived from a certain chemical released in people's brains when they climax, shall we say. And unfortunately, this leaves them dead. And so there's like this kind of AIDS allegory as this woman finds she can, unbeknownst to her about the aliens or anything, she kind of gets into kind of a little serial killer mode or whatever. And there's like a weird thing with other weird stuff. Anyways,
it's weird.
I found it a hoot because I was also hanging out with friends, some of whom I had not really seen Rocky Horror at that point in time, but some of whom were definitely had hit up some of those like Manchester screenings or midnight screenings
Parkade,
of that back at the Parkade and all that back in the day. But I found it a hoot in that way. So like when my sister and future brother-in-law and future sister-in-law, they're hanging out there. Oh, what do we go to see? It's like, well, Liquid Sky is playing at Cinema City. Did you see that coming? Yeah, it was fun. It was, you know, like that. I didn't really have the language to articulate what they could expect going in there. I think as they approached the cinema, they weren't really expecting a Passage to India or something happening there, which it is not.
Yeah, no, Merchant Ivory had the project for a while and then they dropped it.
They
let go of it. So, I mean, you know, Millie, there is that. There's different ways to consume these kinds of products. And I was listening to a podcast this morning where a guy was describing watching Skinamarink.
Oh, no.
In bed.
Someone had to mention it.
Skinamarink with the lights off and on his laptop with headphones on. So that's one thing that you can do. But that feels a little odd. And Millie, I know that there's a sense that when you find all the other people who love this movie, you're a little bit more at home and maybe you feel a little bit less like, you know, Mel Gibson in Conspiracy Theory or something.
Yeah, I have to say there are certain films that I think I just would prefer to watch with other people because it makes me feel less depraved or something that I'm watching alone.
Yep.
I'll give you an example. We did a screening many years ago of a film called Hard Ticket to Hawaii that was directed by a director named Andy Sedaris.
Yes.
Yes. Very, very salacious 80s action movie, I would say. And when we played it with an audience, it was fantastic. Everybody was laughing and, you know, everybody was very engaged, but I kept thinking, if I had gone home and just watched this alone, I don't know if it would be hitting in the same way, if you know what I mean. I would feel kind of weird being alone watching that film. So,
and there are some films that I watch with a group, and then I feel even worse about myself. Films that I've tried to show to other people, like Peter Jackson's Meet the Feebles. Yeah. I thought a bunch of my friends that go to see bands like Cannibal Corpse and Gwar on the regular would be okay with this very outrageous puppet film. So there's sex and drugs and all sorts of horrible things happening with these cute little New Zealand puppets. Hmm. They were all horribly offended by it. So then I feel like I need to retreat and watch films by myself again.
Sam, it's okay. I was there.
Did I force you to watch Meet the Feebles in the 90s?
Yeah. I'm pretty sure you did.
I probably did, yeah.
And I was okay. I was still kind of like little jaw-dropped, but it's like it was a jaw-drop that I'd come to appreciate this side of Liquid Sky.
There you go.
I was educated, Sam.
I think it's fine as long as you don't say, like, particularly to a potential romantic partner, there's no way you can understand me unless you watch this movie.
Don't do that.
You got to be very careful about what movie you show after you kind of say those words.
Pick it very carefully.
Yeah. Yep. You know, Millie, I'm wondering also what you think. This will be the last question. We have to go to a break in about a minute and a half. But in terms of the book, are you expecting people to sort of, you know, kind of use it as homework? Like, you know, I'll just check these off one by one.
I hope so. I mean, I was, you know, very influenced by these types of books when I was growing up. So obviously come from the pre-internet days where you had to go to the library and check out stuff like The Psychotronic Guide to Film or Danny Perry's cult movies books. And so when we came up with the concept for the book, we were really kind of, you know, trying to celebrate those texts and sort of make a contribution. And so that's what I did. I mean, I basically went through the book and checked off. I would make my little, you know, handwritten watch list and then go to the video store and try to rent as much as possible. And that's kind of how I hope people approach this book, except not the video store, because there are very little video stores left in the world. But, you know, just, yeah, use it as a kind of guide for them.
Yeah, we're going to have to go to a break here pretty soon. But yes, all of that. And I do feel as though I miss the video stores a little bit, at least the video stores where there might be some people who worked there who actually liked movies, which was, you know, a toss-up. It didn't always happen. But what's going to happen here, we're going to talk a lot more on the show today about cult classics, about cult movies with these wonderful guests. You'll hear a little bit more from David Edelstein, I think, as we go along. But right now, we're going to go to a break. Some very nice people are going to ask you to support this company and this station and this radio show. Please do it. It's really important. It's especially important this time around. I'd love to be able to show the higher-ups that you folks care enough about crazy shows like this to put a little bit of money on the line for them. So thank you already in advance.
Let's do the time warp again.
It's just a jump to the left.
And then a step to the right.
With your hands on your hips.
Support for this podcast comes from Hartford Healthcare.
Elevating Health is funded by Hartford Healthcare. ECMO is a leading-edge, life-saving treatment for patients with cardiac or respiratory failure. Dr. Jason Gluck, director of the Mechanical Circulatory Support Program and Emergency Cardiac Care at Hartford Hospital, explains what it is.
So ECMO stands for extracorporeal membrane oxygenation, outside the body oxygenation of blood. It's a life support technique that's used by highly sophisticated medical systems for patients with severe heart or lung failure. The technique involves removing blood from the body, oxygenating it, and then returning it back.
ECMO procedures happen in the ICU, but not all hospitals are equipped with the necessary technology and staff. Dr. Gluck describes Hartford Hospital's ECMO Go team.
So ECMO is considered when treatments have failed, and in our center, with a special ECMO on the go team, we'll actually take that technology to their hospital and help them out there if they need to stabilize the patient and then bring them back to heart for recovery.
For more information, go to ctpublic.org/elevatinghealth.
Well, you used to really be scared here.
Johnny.
Hey, you're still afraid.
Stop it now, I mean it.
They're coming to get you, Barbara.
Stop it. You're ignorant.
They're coming for you, Barbara.
Stop it. You're acting like a child.
Look, they're coming for you. Look, there comes one of them now.
He'll hear you.
Here he comes now. I'm getting out of here.
Johnny. Mom!
That, of course, was from The King's Speech. No, it was not. So we're talking about cult movies today. The laughter you hear are the Culture Dogs. We'll be reintroducing them in just a second. Well, Sam Hatch and Kevin O'Neill.
O'Toole.
Sam Neill.
Sam Neill. Somewhere in here.
Something like that. And joining us is also Millie DeShirico, co-author of the TCM Underground, 50 Must-See Films from the World of Classic Cult and Late Night Cinema, and co-host of the I Saw What You Did film podcast. And we'll be hearing, I think, probably from David Edelstein at least one more time today. I think we should talk a little bit about how people do find these things. And, you know, in the old days, you had that friend, you know, Kevin O'Toole or maybe Sam Hatch, yes. Or in my case, Garrett Condon. And Garrett Condon was like the person who described Eraserhead to me and imitated the baby. And, and you know, when he saw Liquid Sky, he totally got it and walked around saying delicious, delicious for days. But you needed that person. But I feel like, you know, Sam, in some ways, the environment is set up now for you to find that movie, you know, without a whole lot of trouble. If somebody's putting out a movie like this, it's not going to roll into the gutter. It's going to go and hit the pins, to use a Big Lebowski.
Yeah, for sure. And part of the fun was always being the proselytizer. You need to sit down and see this film. I've got this wacky copy on VHS with a magic marker scrawled on it, like I found in some store in Boston somewhere, and you need to watch this. So, it's a little bit saddening to be out of that job, essentially, because stuff is so micro-marketed between streamers like Shudder that are, beaming directly at people that are kind of hungry for cult films. And I was just thinking about how A24 in particular is churning out films that are essentially cult films, but they're going directly to their audience. Films like Ari Aster's Midsommar and Hereditary were pretty successful right out of the gate, and they found their audience. Robert Eggers is The Witch. I was thinking about how that would have been an obscure kind of folk horror film like Eyes of Fire from the 80s had it been released in the 80s. But now it's got an instant audience. So, yeah, so it's exciting as someone who wants access to interesting films. But then it's also a bit of a downer for someone that wants to be the guy that goes around going, hey, you got to see this.
So let's hear our friend David Edelstein on this same topic. This is B1 Maestro.
What's fascinating now is that anybody can build a cult around anything. All you have to do is set up a Facebook page. And if there's some movie, if I really love Sandy Duncan Disney movies, I can do a search on Facebook or some other social media and I can find it. And indeed I did, because I love myself some Sandy Duncan. And you just never know. These can have several hundred people or they can have 10,000 people. There are actresses in B movies. I subscribe to their feeds. who have just become famous for one B movie or another. I saw King Kong Escapes at an early age, you know, from 1965. And Linda Miller, you know, the person who was wriggling in the fake hand of, they didn't even dub her with her own voice. It's a Japanese movie. There are devoted Linda Miller devotees. We are in the cult. Anybody can have a cult now. Anybody can build a cult. That's what's so empowering about social media.
You know, and Millie, your book starts, we should say that one of the ways people found these movies in the past was TCM Underground, which you curated. But I think your book, starts maybe around the 1960s, because to have cult movies, you have to have choices. You have to have 100 movies that you could conceivably see, and, you know, you only see maybe the 10 most popular ones. You miss the cult ones. I mean, for a long time, he mentioned King Kong. My mother saw, as a little girl, she saw King Kong in 1933 and was afraid to walk home from the movie theater. And her father was very angry and had to come and get her. But it was like the only movie playing in town. In some ways, the sweet spot of maybe cult classics or cult movies, Millie, might have been during that time where there were enough movies so that you could see some and skip others and maybe not so much algorithmic guiding of you to your choices.
Yeah, I mean, I think also, too, we were kind of in this, almost kind of like a grindhouse exploitation drive-in tradition too, where, there were B pictures being made. It was part of the industry and sort of a part of a tradition of films that would kind of play after the good movie or play in only really bad parts of town. And so by nature of that, people weren't really able to see these things either, unless you were willing to take a really big risk or stay late or whatever after the first feature played. So there was always going to be movies that were kind of just like almost kind of thrown away or kind of, put to the side. And then other more popular movies kind of persisted and kept going. But I think what's different now is that it's kind of an even playing field in terms of like what kind of comes out, because there's so much content that comes out now, you know, and like some of it, again, is like sort of manufactured in the cult tradition, but is probably made by a big studio with like lots of money and, you know, sometimes even a major studio. But I think it's very different now that we're in an algorithmic culture where, you know, things are just kind of popping up all the time and sometimes without context.
I mean, the other part of this, Kevin, is that movies can get made. I mean, the whole entire history of the movies that we've been talking about involves a lot of people maxing out their parents' credit cards.
Yeah, for sure.
And making this movie.
Hi, Kevin Smith. How are you?
Yeah. So, but now you can kind of establish, there's a movie that came out last year that you guys are going to supply me of the title because I can't remember it right now. Oh, it's called Talk to Me. It's an Australian movie. One of those things, you know, things we've all been through. You go to a high school party, somebody brought an embalmed hand.
Sure.
But those guys are twin brothers in Australia who were on YouTube. They had like a YouTube channel talking about movies. They make the movie for $4.5 million. It grosses $70 million, which isn't like, you know, Oppenheimer or Barbie, but it means you can make another movie. I mean, the paths are, they're all over the place. These guys got famous on YouTube, just making fun of other people's movies or whatever.
Yeah. Colin, are you trying to propose a business plan to myself and Sam?
Yeah, let's get together and craft a cult film.
my credit cards are already
any minute now.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, yeah, you can do it any number of ways. And Millie talking about the major studios, it's like when you use the phrase major studios these days, you now have to include Netflix and the larger Disney and such, and you have to include you know, Hulu or whoever is paying for the distribution. It's like there's a lot more ways to do it. But I will say, in the age with the streaming services, with the algorithms, I did try for a laugh because I knew it wasn't going to work. I kind of put, or I had less faith. I put in the words cult movies into a search there, and sure, you might get a couple of things. I think Netflix was the most successful in my little search there, but the rest of them that I would spit back was all like documentaries about people who joined cults and kind of stuff. So yeah, it's and you do fare better, however, when you have like a book like Millie's or some other resource where you have a title and you can plug that in there and says, and they might do better if you say, sorry, we don't have that. Here's this other stuff that's like that. But you're rolling the dice on that one. You have to have like a specific to get to your specific thing, you still have to kind of need to focus in a different way and focus the algorithm in a different way.
And in terms of getting things done, I was flashing back to early in our show, we interviewed Shane Carruth, who directed Primary Colors and the second film, but Primer, which we were given permission to call Primer by him,
right?
But that was a film where he was working a day job and was sneaking out and going to film school, like while he was on lunch break, essentially, and really put that thing together on a shoestring budget. Mm-hmm. But it's a fantastic science fiction
time travel film
that will end up exploding your brain.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, Millie, there's an earned quality from the fan base. That's what they're really talking about here, is the effort that might get put into discovering something, the effort that might, you know, go into even being able to find something, particularly back in the day, and the toil of it. I mean, the opposite of that, I like you to talk about that, but also the opposite of that, a movie like Sharknado, which clearly was made just to be that kind of thing, with no effort put into discovery, with no sense of ambivalence. A lot of cult movies, you really love them, but you can kind of laugh at them or laugh at yourself for loving them. You know, Sharknado just tries to do all that for you. It's sort of pre-chewed and pre-digested, and that doesn't really feel right somehow.
Yeah, agreed. I'm kind of weary of a movie that kind of presents itself as a cult movie up front. Like, hey, check out this like weird concept and, you know, bring your friends and watch it at midnight. I'm kind of like, I feel like the audience kind of creates that vibe versus you telling me that's the vibe, if you know what I mean. And they're into your point about the toil. I toiled for many years and I appreciate that. I couldn't find, you know, there was a period of my life where I could not find, as a teenager, Asian action films. And I would have to like go downtown and actually buy VHS tapes off of people on the street that would sell VHS tapes on the street. Mm-hmm. And that is like such a weird concept to anyone that has the internet now, because I'm sure all of that stuff's on YouTube or on a pirated site or whatever. But, you know, I earned that right to call this a cult movie because I went and made it that way. It presented itself in that way to me, that it was rare, hard to find. A lot of people were kind of, you know, talking about it that were cool and kind of, you know, the cool people in my school or whatever. And so I don't know, that little world to me has always been attractive and safe for me. So
yeah, I would buy boxes of Hong Kong films dubbed from Laserdiscs from a guy out in San Diego, and that box would arrive at my house, and it'd be like Christmas in July. I'd be like, oh my God, this is going to be fantastic. Butterfly and Sword, I can't wait to watch this.
A Better Tomorrow Part 3,
exactly. And Upstream Color was the other Shane Carruth film.
Yes,
I was thinking
that
of
was
earlier.
It. Yes.
Sorry.
Yep.
Yes, Jonathan just he provided that to me.
Thank you, Jonathan.
I didn't want
Thank
to seem Jonathan. Smarter than I really am. So the ultimate version of this is a 1930s movie called The Monkey's Paw, of which there is one print in existence in the private collection of a French collector. And it's an American movie dubbed into French. So even if you were able to see this one print, if somebody would, in fact, transfer it into video or something like that, it would still be dubbed into French. That's the ultimate toil. All right, let's take a little break. We're going to come back. We've got a few more things, or maybe a lot more things to say about cult movies, cult classics. Let's take a break. We'll come right back. And we are back. Time to say some thank yous, starting with our technical producer, the maestro, Dylan Reyes. And then we're very excited that this particular episode was produced by one of our two interns at this time. They're wrapping up their storied tenure. Sagina Shrestha produced this episode. Thanks also to the Metrograph in New York, which is where she was collecting the Vox from the people who talk in funny ways like they are actually cult movie fans. And Jonathan McPants is kind of the associate producer on this show, but doing an awful lot of the work there. We thank him as well. And then our guests, we're very excited to have in the studio with us. This is, woo, it's historic, really. We're just starting to have people back in the studio. But with us are the Culture Dogs, Kevin O'Toole and Sam Hatch. And then Millie is with us as well. We're excited about her and her book. And we're going to talk towards the end here about, first of all, I'd like to, and maybe Millie, we can begin with you. It seems to me that there are people these days who are mainstream directors, who are in, you know, conversations for Academy Awards and things like that, who strike me as kind of also trying to make movies so specific to their own aesthetic that they border on what used to be the cult aesthetic. I mean, I think Wes Anderson is an example. I think Yorgos Lanthimos, who obviously with Poor Things made quite a big splash this year. Those movies kind of have that kind of rejection of conventional wisdom about how to make a movie and quirkiness that we think of in terms of cult movies. And yet somehow or other, they're not. They're almost like a new species or something. I don't know. What are your thoughts, Millie?
Yeah, I mean, kind of going back to that conversation about A24 films, I mean, it's interesting. I keep hearing the term elevated horror when it comes to the A24 movies. And I'm like, what does that actually mean? Because, you know, I feel like elevated horror, I mean, if you look at something like Midsommar or, you know, some of the folk horror films that have come out sort of semi-recently, I mean, they're essentially like movies that were being made in the 70s. I mean, I think of a movie like Messiah of Evil or, you know, something like that, where it's like kind of an artsy horror film. Like Let's Scare Jessica to Death is probably another good example. So it's not as if they're kind of like reinventing the wheel necessarily, but part of me is like, is it because they actually have some money to make these movies now and they didn't back in the 70s where, you know, these are really tight budgets and, you know, people were just getting their friends to be in movies for free. But it's interesting because, yeah, I feel like it's kind of in a way like having it both ways in certain regards, like having financial the financial structure to make bigger pictures, but still wanting to make them in this like cheapy way that they had made them before.
Yeah, I there's also that pleasure of discovery. And Sam, there was a movie that inexplicably I had not heard of that you apparently did mention to somebody at some point called The Man Who Killed Hitler and Then the Bigfoot.
Yep. Yes, and it was actually shot in Massachusetts too, so it's fairly local to us. But
it's not to be confused with Terror at Bigfoot Pond, which is hippies in their underpants getting killed, I think. But anyway.
And it's just one of those films that on the surface you think it's going to be a Snakes on a Plane. Like it's got a catchy, extremely absurd title. You're going to watch it and it's going to have this built-in kind of cult aesthetic. But you get it and it's actually this really kind of interesting, almost like a Western, like Unforgiven or something, like this kind of rumination on getting old and you know, the horrors you've seen becoming this aged, you know, person in the small town that nobody quite understands. And yeah, come to find out, the main character did in fact go on a mission and took out Hitler and then now has to return from retirement to take out Bigfoot. But it contains none of the nonsense that you would expect from a film entitled The Man Who Killed Hitler and Then the Bigfoot. So it almost, the cult audience that it was meant for almost rejected it immediately because it was not the thing that they thought it was going to be. But it's such a fantastic film that it deserves to now find its own cult audience for different reasons.
Yeah, you know, and Kevin, I feel like when we talk about these movies, there's, I think some people think these are movies that would be sort of laughable. I think maybe that title might have made Sam people think, oh, this is a movie that I can see and I kind of enjoy, but I'll be laughing up my sleeve at it.
Exactly, yeah.
But that isn't always the case with cult movies, right? Cult movies are things that you love, and then maybe you have a little bit of a laugh about it afterwards.
Absolutely, absolutely. You may find somebody acting over the top or a lot of the acting over the top there. But then it gets to hit a certain point and you're like, wait a minute, what did that movie just kind of do to me? It's like David Lynch's stuff from early on, Eraserhead, you know, you can definitely throw comfortably anytime into the cult films category. But even I had this category of films that I would kind of put together in my mind from an early film going and watching thing called 4 in the morning movies, where I would be up late and maybe find something on cable. And I think I found like Blue Velvet halfway through at that point, and not even half, like 2/3 of the way through. So it's the last scene in her apartment. There's a guy who's plugged into the wall there, who's standing there, and other things going on. Very Blue Velvety things.
I took people to see that in the theater. Bad idea.
Yeah.
Don't take friends to see Blue Velvet.
In order to understand me, you need to see this movie, Blue Velvet, or you'll just never get me.
Yeah. This is me writ large.
So I want to ask all three of you to maybe make some nominations, either of cult movies that you really, I should say that Millie, because of your book, TCM Underground, 50 Must See Films from the World of Classic Cult and Late Night Cinema, co-authored by Millie DeShirico. My son and I are going to watch Let's Scare Jessica to Death this on Sunday night of this week. We'll let you know how things turn out. But I'd love for you to maybe either recommend a cult movie that you think somebody should see or a movie that you think may move into cult status. While you're thinking of your answer, I'll just say my nominee is Brigsby Bear, a Kyle Mooney movie, which I think nobody saw. And it's funny and touching and warm. And it has Mark Hamill in it as a dad. I'm just amazed more people don't know about it and like it. But Millie, why don't you start us off?
Sure. I feel like I've recommended this before. So if anybody's listening and has heard me say the name of this film, I apologize. But I think my pick is going to have to be a movie called The Baby from 1973. It is a Ted Post film starring Ruth Roman. It has one of the weirdest premises I've ever heard in my life. It's essentially a grown man who acts like a baby. And that's pretty much it.
You didn't really sell it. But
Colin, if you want to understand Millie, you have to watch The Baby.
And I do. I want to understand Millie. All right. So, Kevin, you go next.
Okay. The thing I was going to mention, Repo Man, I feel like such a tool just throwing that one out there. But hey, it's definitely available on streaming right now. I found it on Netflix, of all things.
Although, watched it a couple weeks ago again for the first time in a while.
Yeah. Although you can't watch it with English subtitles up. You only got Spanish subtitles available on that one. I don't know how that happened, but it's still a great movie. Emilio Estevez on something that looks like the LA punk scene, although put it maybe 20 minutes into the future, where there's a guy driving around who has an aliens in his trunk, and Harry Dean Stanton recruits Emilio Estevez to repossess cars.
And the more you drive, the less intelligent you become.
There you go.
All right, Sam, take it home for us.
I'm just going to drop a quick reference and recommendation to Philip Ridley's The Reflecting Skin, one of my favorite kind of criminally underseen 90s films with Viggo Mortensen. But I was asked to kind of pull some newer stuff out of the ether. And one of the things I recommended to Kevin recently was a Swedish-English film called Aniara. If you're into science fiction films, this thing is based on a 50s science fiction tone poem, like novel length. And it's essentially a spacecraft that is supposedly en route to Mars, but it gets knocked off course. And cults actually are created in space, because what else are you going to do when you're drifting endlessly in space? And I loved in the book, Millie's book, there was these WTF moments, where there are these kind of amazing moments in each film that are the thing that excite you about it. And the WTF moment in this film is when the main character is essentially the guardian of this holodeck-esque supercomputer that processes human memories of a now dead Earth and kind of soothes all the humans on the ship. And it kills itself because it's tired of humans deluging it with all their problems. So,
and that music means we're all going to just follow suit, I guess. Anyway, the show is over. No, don't worry about that.
We killed the holiday.
No heaven's gate type stuff of any kind. Millie DeShirico, so great to have you on the show. Also, Sam Hatch, Kevin O'Toole. Thanks to my friend David Edelstein. Thanks for listening today. People are going to come on. They're very nice people, and they're going to tell you, I sound like Trump, they're very nice people, you know, but they're going to ask you to support this radio station. Please, please do it. Do it during our hour. It really helps us a lot.